You're listening to Radiotopia Presents from PRX's Radiotopia.
Hi, I'm Willa Paskin, the host of Decoder Ring, Slate's podcast about cracking cultural mysteries. On Decoder Ring, we dive down rabbit holes and obsessively explore questions hiding in plain sight. Like, why has slow dancing gone out of style? And when did we all become obsessed with hydration? And where did the word mullet, you know, to describe a hairstyle, come from? That's Decoder Ring, named one of the best podcasts of 2023 by the New York Times. Listen to new episodes every 2 weeks and make sure to follow us so you never miss one.
We all have them. Secrets. Small little precious boxes of memories of something that can't be shared. Because if you do, then it would cease to exist as a secret and turn into something else.
So think about it. What we have here is an illegal plot conducted without political permission by MI6.
This is a show about those secrets.
Funding an Al-Qaeda offshoot in Libya.
Brought to you by Showcase from PRX's Radiotopia.
To try and illegally assassinate a foreign head of state, it goes wrong and innocent people die. How much worse can it get?
This is the last episode of this six-part series. In the past episodes, you've heard about people's lives who've been affected forever by their own or others' secrets. And in this final episode, you will hear one last story.
To go in through this splintered door with everything ripped up, all my possessions and everything scattered everywhere. But they ripped up the carpets, they ripped up the floorboards, they ripped the bath apart, they stole our bed sheets. They went through my underwear drawer and left it scattered all over the floor. So it was pretty horrible to walk into what had been my home of 4 years to see this.
And you've followed Mohammed El Abed, who tries to understand his father, Benessa, the father who married Mohammed's mother young in an arranged marriage in Morocco, who had three families, conceived 11 children, and died of brain cancer in 1999, leaving behind him unanswered questions. This is the final episode, where we finally meet Maria, the secret sister.
Samira, sluta! Jag håller på och kör.
This is me. And my daughter, Samira. It's late in November. We're having an argument. We are driving to see my sister Maria. My daughter, she thinks it's too far. I tried to tell her to have patience.
Samira, sluta. Snart där. Samira, jag kör.
If you remember from the first episode, it was Samira who first got me thinking of my father by asking who he was.
Pappa, kan du berätta om farfar?
It started a chain reaction inside of me.
Min pappa, din farfar, han har många hemligheter.
All circulating around the fact that I had a secret sister, Maria. It's been more than 25 years since I first found out about her. Since then, we have had brief contact with each other over the years. The last time I talked to her was over the phone 2 years ago. But we have never really talked. We have never sat down. We have never tried to understand what really happened. How she became a secret. So that's why we are driving to her home. Just an hour's drive from Stockholm. 1 hour that almost feels like a lifetime. Not only for Samira, but also for me. I drive, and I try to imagine what it must be like to be Maria. I try to imagine what it must be like to be a secret.
You feel quite disconnected from the outside world. So it's like a pane of glass comes up between you and the normal world outside.
What it does to you.
You could be walking around the streets of London, knowing that there is an operation going on, and seeing everyone else around you, not knowing that anything spooky was happening. Or sometimes you had a successful operation, stopped something happening, and it might be reported a tiny bit in the mainstream media, but it's the tip of the iceberg, and you know everything else.
This is Annie Macon. She used to work for MI5.
So again, you get this disconnected feeling. It is very strange.
MI5 is the National Security Intelligence in the United Kingdom. Once, Annie was a codename in a much greater machinery.
So your codename is effectively what your position is. Mine was F2B5 in the counter-subversion section, then T5E2, and then G3A2.
That was 27 years ago, when Annie was 23 years old and the year was 1991. And Annie didn't really want to become a spy. She applied for a job at an embassy and received a strange letter as a reply. A letter with a phone number. She called it. And after 10 months of training, that was it. She was in.
Yeah, it was very surreal the first few weeks because you don't get much training. You're sort of lobbed into the job, to your desk, and you sort of learn on the job pretty much. And for the first few weeks, you're handling all this secret information, and it's very surreal. You are given a target. In my case, it was subversion, and groups to go and investigate. And then you have to deploy a whole range of different investigative techniques, be it telephone tapping or electronic communications or planting bugs in their homes or workplace or whatever, up to and including recruiting human agents in that group, which you run and they report back to you. So you're reading people's private telephone conversations, you're reading people's private emails. And then you have to decide if someone's a threat, do you carry on investigating? If not, do you shut it down? And of course, if you're working on other targets like terrorism, sometimes you need to take the executive decision to go to the police and get them to arrest someone because they might be about to put a bomb down.
But this isn't a typical spy story. This is a story of how two spies decided to expose the secrets of other spies, and therefore in the end becoming secrets themselves hidden in the French countryside. But before we go there, we must begin from the beginning, because this story began when Annie met her future boyfriend, David.
Yeah, David was the new boy. He had joined about 7 months after me, and we actually met in the library of F2. He was having his lunch, but we were both in long-term relationships with outsiders at that point. So we were friends for about a year, got to know each other.
Outsiders, that's a term to define if you're together with someone outside of the intelligence. Those relationships usually end due to the nature of the job. And so after a while, Annie and David became a couple.
He was very bright, very quick, very challenging with the management as well. He was always one of the people to ask the difficult questions, which I liked. So, we were just part of the same group, we were friends, and eventually became more than friends.
And the two watched from inside how MI5 treated people in society without them knowing, bending the laws in order to get information. For example, wiretapping British journalists without them doing anything illegal, or gathering information for special intelligence files on prominent Labour politicians. Or how MI5 received information about a nationalistic Libyan terrorist cell working with Al-Qaeda attempting to assassinate the Libyan dictator Gaddafi.
And this occurred in late 1995, and at that time David was working as G9A5, and he was the head of the Libyan section, and he'd built up an unusually close working relationship with his counterparts in MI6, which is highly unusual because the two agencies hate each other. They pretend to have a united front, but there's so much competition there. But he and PT16B got on, so they sort of initiated proper briefing channels between the two organisations on the subject of Libya.
One day, PT16B at MI6 called Annie's boyfriend David to brief him on a special subject, and they needed to meet in person.
Now, normally you had very secure communications, you could talk on the telephone, so you knew this was ultra secret, it had to be done in person. So he went over to 6 and was told by PT16B that there'd been a volunteer, a walk-in, to the British Embassy in Tunis. And in this case, the volunteer was then codenamed Tumworth. He was a senior Libyan military intelligence officer. And he basically said, can I see the local MI6 officer, because he was working embassies. And came out with the idea that they wanted to get rid of Gaddafi. He said he had a plot coming together. There was a ragtag group of Islamists, I think he called them, and what they needed was funding from MI6 in order to equip this rebel group and to, just buy the weapons and even just the kit, jeeps, tents, that sort of thing. And MI6 got terribly excited about this very, very quickly. They immediately started pushing money to Tumworth at sort of secret meetings across Europe.
Now here's where things become a bit complicated. operations are being done by spy organisations across the world all the time. And according to British law, if the agents are doing something illegal, like killing someone, for example, the Foreign Secretary needs to say if the operation should proceed. So, for example, if MI6 would fund a Libyan nationalistic terrorist cell affiliated with Al-Qaeda that's planning to kill another country's leader, according to British law, they need a written consent to be able to stand above the law. And if they don't have that written consent, the operation de facto becomes illegal. And here's the thing. David suspected that MI6 didn't have that written consent. So when David found out about the plan to fund terrorism, he gave the information to his bosses.
He was concerned about the ethics, you know, taking out a foreign head of state. So he did push his concerns up the management chain. But he was told to just shut up and don't rock the boat.
And David was indeed quiet. And on the 6th of March 1996, you could read in the newspapers that a car travelling in a convoy belonging to Gaddafi had been attacked by grenades, killing several civilians. Gaddafi wasn't in the convoy and survived.
However, in early 1996, he saw various intelligence reports coming across his desk indicating there had indeed been an attack against Gaddafi, which had gone wrong and which had killed innocent people.
The terrorists fled to Afghanistan and was, according to some Arabic newspapers, a part of actually getting Gaddafi deposed much later in 2011.
So think about it. What we have here is an illegal plot conducted without political permission by MI6, funding an Al-Qaeda offshoot in Libya at a time when Al-Qaeda was known to be the emerging terror threat. To try and illegally assassinate a foreign head of state, it goes wrong and innocent people die. How much worse can it get?
They decide to leave the agency in 1996, both David and Annie. But the story doesn't end here.
We knew something had to be done, but it was trying to work out exactly what were the right ways to do it, try and avoid as much harm as possible. Well, it was difficult.
Because Annie and David decides to expose what they thought was wrong in the way that MI5 and MI6 worked.
And I think what tipped the balance was that I come from a journalistic family, and David had been a journalist, so he sort of knew how the game was played. We had a fighting chance to create a big enough story, so create a big enough scandal, so that that would force the government to review what the spies were doing and how they were overseen. So that was the aim of it, but it was a fucking ginormous risk for us to take. And in the UK, of course, you automatically face prison.
According to a law in the United Kingdom called the National Secrets Act that exists in order to protect the state from espionage, it's illegal for employees or former employees of the Security and Intelligence Service to disclose information. If you do, you go to prison. So if you do decide to leak to the press about the fact that you got information about wiretapping and an attempted coup on Gaddafi, information that you got from an agent at MI6 who told you that they were planning to fund a terrorist cell opposing the regime, you're, according to the National Secrets Act, doing something illegal.
We had a situation where as soon as we spoke to anyone outside the agency, we broke that law. And there was no legal defence whatsoever. It was a clear, bright line.
The plan was to tell the press what they knew and then leave the country. Annie was going to keep in the background, and David was going to be the one with the information, in order to protect Annie if they ever were caught. And also, if David somehow was stuck in exile, then Annie could be an ambassador of the case and still travel. And much was at stake.
We would automatically face arrest, and then automatically face 2 years per charge for a breach of the Official Secrets Act. So we had decided to get out of the country.
To prove his claims, David starts stealing documents from work and he gives it to a journalist at the English conservative tabloid newspaper Mail on Sunday. In total, it's 28 documents, mostly concerning wiretapping and the sensitive files on high-level British politicians. And the newspaper takes the information, but they need to confirm everything for themselves, and it takes time.
That the recruitment process to work with this journalist took a good 10 months, and that was partly because Dave, of course, was very paranoid that they would tell MI5 about him and he'd go to prison without saying anything. So it's a long time to sit around waiting, worried MI5 was getting suspicious and might come and arrest you at any moment. And also the journalists and the newspaper were worried it was MI5 set up. So it was a very, very slow courtship and took forever.
So Annie and David resigns in October 1996. And in August 1997, the phone rings from Mail and Sunday. The newspaper is going to do a profile on David about the wiretapping and the sensitive profiles that MI5 had on politicians, but not the Gaddafi story, not yet. And the profile on David was going to be published in 3 days.
So I remember David went in to meet the editor of the newspaper on the Tuesday. The story was going to break on the Saturday. So between that Tuesday and the weekend, David spent every waking hour at the newspaper office in a sort of hermetically sealed room, apparently working with the journalists. And I was the one trying to sort out the logistics of getting out of the country, where we'd go, how we'd do it, you know, how we could afford it, everything. So it was a real nightmare. I spent that week running around London from telephone box to telephone box, extracting as much cash as I could. And the problem was, of course, I couldn't be seen. I had to be really careful. I couldn't be seen to be doing anything really weird, like clearing out the flat. If we were under observation at that point, then they'd say, what the hell's going on? It happened so quickly, with so little warning even for us. I don't think they caught up with the fact it was going to happen until too late.
And then was the question of even getting out of the country.
Getting out of the country is the tricky bit. I think I got the last 2 seats on an airplane out of the UK that weekend. We had a really early morning flight out on the 23rd of August from Heathrow. So I'd booked us into a hotel right next to the airport. And we had to get up at 4 o'clock to make that flight. We knew that the die was cast, that they were going to run that story and it would be hitting the streets on the front pages. We had to get out of the country. And that was, you know, we could not afford to miss that flight. So I remember putting in place about 5 alarm clocks to make sure we woke up. And I remember sitting on that plane as it took off, just thinking, oh, thank God, we're safe. And we flew to Amsterdam and then went and hid in a little hotel in Utrecht. So it was surreal, you know, getting to this little hotel that we paid for in cash in Utrecht. And then just sitting in the hotel room thinking, we can't, you know, let's go out. And we went out for a sort of dinner. Found this little place, ironically called Casa David. I remember it really clearly. It was on the edge of a canal. And we were sitting there around the time when we knew the newspapers would be hitting the streets of London that night. The one issue we had as well is because we were so paranoid about security before we left, we couldn't tell anyone what we were planning. You know, none of our families, none of our friends, nothing. Our families all found out, unfortunately, by reading the front page of the newspapers. So we were sort of calling them up from different payphones around Utrecht and trying to calm them down and reassure them and things like that. Back in 1997, if you called in to someone's telephone number, they didn't have the capability to trace where the call was coming from. So that meant that we could still call our family, call other people.
The plan was originally to keep Annie out of the spotlight. David was going to be the one that was in the newspaper, since he was the one that had stolen files from work, and he was the one that had gotten information about the Gaddafi plot, so that Annie would be protected from any harm. But both were on the run.
The story became front page news on the 24th of August. Then we had a week literally on the run round the Netherlands. We knew that they would be after us, so we kept changing hotels. The Mail on Sunday journalists came out as well that week to do further stories with David. And they wanted me to come out in his support as well. So there's quite a lot of pressure put on me to do that. And we were sort of in their charge at that time. They had a car and we were driving across from town to town, moving from hotel to hotel with them. And it felt a bit like swimming with sharks, actually. Because as an intelligence officer with MI5, one of the things you do is recruit agents and run them into groups and then go and debrief them and get the information. So they're your source. And suddenly, from that position, we find ourselves being the source of journalists who want to do exactly the same to you. So it was a strange and very powerful inversion. It took quite some getting used to.
Eventually, Annie agrees to be interviewed. So the next weekend, she knows that she's going to be on the cover of the Mail on Sunday.
So on the Saturday, we were in The Hague, and I said, right, we're getting out of this country, we're going as far and as fast as you can. Come on, we've got to go, you know, now, out of this town, out of this country, by train. And I had the sort of book of the train, European train timetables, keep everything offline, you know, just have the book. And looked at the routes and said, right, we can get to Paris, and then we can get all the way down to the far southwest of France to a city called Bayonne in a day. Let's do it. Took us 8 hours, and we got to Bayonne, found a little hotel, and it was exhausting. It was steamingly hot down there at that time of year. And it was just like, phew, we got away again. And I remember it was lovely. It was a little hotel on the river. And we were sitting out on the terrace and we had a bit of dinner. First proper food we'd eaten in days. And we just thought, God, we've done it. We've done it. And we're still free. This is amazing. And we went to bed sort of fairly relaxed and fairly happy for the first time in ages. And woke up the next morning and I remember Dave was watching the news and I was showering. And all I heard was from the hotel room was, oh, fuck.
This is BBC television from London. Diana, Princess of Wales, has died after a car crash in Paris.
I was like, oh, shit.
The French government announced her death just before 5 o'clock this morning. Buckingham Palace confirmed the news shortly afterwards. Normal programmes have been suspended while we bring you the latest developments throughout the
morning. Because we knew immediately the implications. This is like the big one of the biggest stories of the century. So we'd be wiped out of any media coverage, which meant that we lost any traction with the government of trying to force an inquiry and reform. We'd lose any media protection as whistleblowers. It was a nightmare. Suddenly, you know, after 1 week, we found ourselves literally lost in Europe on our own, on the run from MI5. And it was like, okay, what do we do? So we stayed put for a couple more days in that hotel and then, of course, started moving around from different town to different city, onwards and onwards. It was like a sort of backpacking holiday with the spies after us. Being very security conscious as well. Not talking in hotel rooms, just in case they did catch up with us and they planted a bug in it. I mean, it was, you know, real ultra security and real ultra paranoia as well. And yet at the same time, we were in the sort of playground of France. It was like a holiday as well, you know. It was very, very strange and very frightening.
After a month of hiding, Annie decides that it's time to fly back to the United Kingdom to be that ambassador for the case that they had planned all along. But she also knew that she would be arrested if she did. So her lawyer decides to tell the authorities so that they know in advance in order to get as much attention as possible. He then joins Annie on the flight to the UK. It's Annie, the lawyer, and a journalist and a photographer.
When I got to the immigration desk at Gatwick Airport, there were six big special branch officers standing there saying, we're arresting you for a breach of the Official Secrets Act and we're arresting you for money laundering. All this happens very, very publicly. And what was worse was one or two of the guys in this group were mates of mine from when I was on the inside of MI5. You know, we worked together. We used to go out drinking together. It was really painful. To stall for time, I said, okay, but can I just go to the loo? So I went to the toilet, and that gave us a little bit of delay time. So by the time we were sort of hustled out of the back entrance of Gatwick, the wonderful photographer who travelled with us had made his way somehow to that entrance and got all these pictures of me surrounded by all these big, burly police officers, you know, a sort of little blonde woman, because they were really tall. And then they drove me up to the police station and arrested me, put me through all the motions, made me tip out my bag of possessions on the floor, which was filthy, in the front, you know, reception of the police station, and then locked me up in this cell, which had shit and things smeared all over the walls. It was pretty disgusting. And they kept me there, interviewing me 3 times, I think, during that day. They kept me there for the rest of the day with my lawyer, until they eventually released me because I hadn't done anything. But they kept me, they never charged me with anything either.
Annie then walks home together with a friend, Gemma, to the apartment that she and David had just left without any notice. And they find that it has been searched by the MI5.
They trashed it, so it was a real shock to go in through this splintered door with everything ripped up, all my possessions and everything scattered everywhere. They ripped up the carpets, they ripped up the floorboards, they ripped the bath apart, they stole our bed sheets. They went through my underwear drawer and left it scattered all over the floor. So it was pretty horrible to walk into what had been my home of 4 years to see this. And I remember Gem and I just looking at each other in horror, went out to a pub and got pretty drunk for the rest of the afternoon. It seemed like the only sane response. I couldn't face that flat at that point.
After a week of packing up the flat and meeting with the family, it's time to go back.
But I was very, very careful. I mean, you know, I used all the techniques to make sure I wasn't being followed.
Now, David has hidden in France because they hope that a law that exists in France back then would apply also to them.
David had holed up in a secret little primitive farmhouse.
Both Annie and David hope that that French law about whistleblowers means that they can't be extradited back to the United Kingdom, since that's what both David and Annie means that they are, whistleblowers. So Annie has to leave the UK, find David, without the MI5 finding her.
If they're going to follow you and they're serious, there will be about 20 people after you. So it involves, you know, checking who's behind you. You can do that by looking in shop windows or by looking in a mirror of a powder compact if you're a woman, looking over your shoulder. But it's really dodging and diving quickly and unexpectedly through places where it's very difficult for them to follow. And the tube is wonderful for that, you know, if you're in London. Or it used to be in those days because the communications didn't work terribly well down there. So if you sort of waited and jumped on a train really fast or jumped off at the last minute and you could see people doing the same thing, then, you know, you probably identified someone who might be following you. And then, you know, immediately into a taxi, then back onto the tube and through department stores or through big hotels or all sorts of stuff like that. And then, of course, I took the Eurostar to Paris, and then I had to get across Paris, so I had another chance to do all that before getting the train down to where I was meeting David. And it was very remote, very isolating. It was in a hamlet of three other houses, and it was a mile away from the nearest village, which had one shop, and it was 15 miles away from the nearest town. So it was very, very, very remote in the least inhabited part of France. It's called La Creuse in the Limousin. And the house was very, very primitive. It was a sort of 19th century farmhouse that hadn't been renovated. It was very cold. We couldn't have a car because you have to register a car. We couldn't have a TV, same problem. The only connection we had with the outside world was a dial-up computer connection, which David used, and that was it. So he was spending a lot of time writing and on the computer and dealing with the lawyers and the legal case and everything. So I was sort of a bit stuck. I was used to living in the centre of London, working in the centre of London. Suddenly I'm stuck in the middle of France with nothing to do. So I became a good little housekeeper for about 10 months, with the 10 months we were there.
In the end of July 1998, the Mail on Sunday wants to make a bigger piece on the attempted coup on Gaddafi, the story that they hadn't published the first time. So David and Annie travels from their safe location to Paris to meet the journalist. But in order for the journalist to be able to tell the story and print it, they need to tell the authorities that they are going to meet with David. Otherwise, the journalist will be prosecuted as well. So traveling back to Paris, the MI5 knows what's about to happen. After they have met the journalist, Annie and David checks in to a hotel.
We were booked into a separate hotel, and something felt wrong there when we went to check in, so we checked out immediately and ran, basically. It's just sometimes you know something's not right. And we went and checked into the hotel where the journalist was staying. They'd tracked us, I think, at that point.
Now David walks out on a short errand.
I was in the hotel room waiting for him to return, and I got a phone call. There was a storm raging outside. I had a phone call from him saying he was taking cover, because he only had a shirt on, until the storm had passed. He'd be back in about 10 minutes. And I remember that knock on the door and the shock of it. They caught him in the reception of the hotel. And I remember asking, "Are you arresting him?" And they said, no, we're just taking him away for questioning. I didn't even have a chance to say goodbye to him.
Suddenly, they're separated.
For me, it was very sort of desolate. I think the hardest thing for both of us was missing each other. You know, we'd been so used to bouncing ideas off each other, not being in the whole thing alone. So suddenly to be on the outside, suddenly having to take control of the whole campaign to free David, to work with the lawyers, to work with the media, was a bit of a shock, shall we say. And dealing with that, as well as the emotional upset of losing my partner, was hard.
David is put into a high-security prison for months. Their only hope is that French law about whistleblowers, the one that states that you can't prosecute them and extradite them. And they were right.
They just let him go as soon as they saw all the paperwork. They realised what he was accused of and had to release him under French law.
Afterwards, they have a party in the hotel room and David sits in the corner.
The saddest thing was that we were in quite a large hotel room and David was so used to sitting in a tiny cell and not moving until he was told to move by the guards. He just sat in one corner of that room and wouldn't move.
2 years pass. They now live in Paris, but they've run out of money, having in the end only £5,000 that their parents given to them. So they finally decide to go back. The plan is that if David gets arrested and is put on trial for leaking the Gaddafi story, they can publicly ask the jury to do a proper investigation on how the British secret services work. And then they both can move on.
We went back on the ferry to the White Cliffs of Dover. And there were hundreds of journalists chasing us around the ferry and things like that. It was just crazy. Absolutely bonkers. And his family travelled back with us as well. His mother, his father, his two brothers. And I remember his poor mother being sort of trampled on in this crush of journalists. It was huge and frightening. And then David was automatically arrested as he entered Dover. And the rest of us went up to London. And he was taken to Charing Cross Police Station and he was interrogated.
But the plan fails. Because David, he isn't charged with the Gaddafi plot.
Now, this is crazy because David was only ever charged with the very low-level first disclosures.
That means that he can't say anything about it in the trial. They've been outsmarted.
So that was a massive stitch-up as well. He wasn't allowed to say anything about his motivation. He wasn't allowed to mention any of the major disclosures up to and including the Gaddafi plot. The question was, how long would he get in prison? And at that point, the lawyers called me. Basically, I had to get up and plead with the judge not to send my man to prison for too long. That was the only time either of us in this whole trial process, all the legal hearings, was ever allowed to say why we had done what we'd done.
David is sentenced to 6 months in prison. The day after, you can read in the British newspapers that the 28 documents that had been stolen and then been given to the Mail on Sunday had risked agents' lives. David served 2 out of those 6 months. A couple of years later, Annie and David separates in 2006. David has now developed an addiction to drugs. He then becomes a part of a cult. He calls himself Messias.
For years, David Shaler has been a thorn in the flesh of Britain's intelligence establishment. An MI5 officer for 6 years, he went to jail after leaking secret documents to the press. In the last 10 years, he's been a novelist, a writer on security matters, and a political activist. But his latest role may be the most talked about yet, that of mystic. Sally Gould went to meet him.
Church bells rang and rang and rang, and I was sitting there feeling slightly uncomfortable. He says, "That's the proclamation of you being the Messiah. You are the Messiah."
He publishes YouTube clips about Christ.
Hello there, hi, and welcome to another bulletin with me, David Shaler, the Christ.
And now lives as a transvestite with his female alter ego, Dolores Cain.
The kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Messiah, and he will reign forever and ever.
Annie has devoted her life to help whistleblowers.
Do you ever miss the life being a secret, like being on the run?
No, it's strange you ask that. Most people say, do you ever miss being a spy? I mean, I've always said that being on the run was actually much more spy-like, like a spy film, than actually being an intelligence officer. No, I don't miss it. Well, apart from, you know, the weight loss, that was great. But no, I just see it as a sort of standalone phase of my life, where I learned a lot, I developed a lot of new skills, and I sort of moved on, and my life is sort of chunked into phases, really, at the moment. And I can't regret any of them, because if I hadn't gone through those phases, I wouldn't be where I am now, and I wouldn't have the skills and the knowledge and the contacts that I have now. So, no, I wouldn't want to go back to that time and that degree of secrecy.
See that, Maria? See that?
Maria, she lives and has always lived in Eskilstuna, which is just 1.5 hours away from Stockholm, the town where the rest of us siblings grew up. So close, but still so far away. I've come to Maria to get answers for the first time in my life.
Okay, so where are we going now?
We're going to the garage. It's the only place we can be alone and without the sound of the children.
To sit down and talk about our father, Ben Asa, for the first time. It turns out Maria had a completely different childhood than I did. She grew up in a house just next to where Maria lives today.
I lived there from 1 to 5, I think. I used to play with my husband when I was little. He was my first best friend.
And today is your best friend still.
Yeah.
But she never grew up with her mother, Sonia, the woman our father met while my mother was still in Morocco, waiting to come to Sweden.
I knew she had a mental illness, and that was why she couldn't take care of me. I think she was schizophrenic.
After Sonia gave birth to Maria, she left her at the hospital and disappeared.
I ended up in an orphanage south of Stockholm, and then I stayed there for 9 months, and then I came to my foster family.
Maria has only met her mother, Sonia, a couple of times before she passed away in the beginning of 2011, leaving behind unanswered questions. Maria has never met her father in person.
I knew his name, but and that was enough for me because I didn't want to know more, because I was trying to create a safe environment. And so I made a big effort to not think about it.
Sometimes her foster parents, without thinking about it, gave her clues about her real family.
It was always because someone had slipped. And I remember once someone said, your father married very young, as a child. I think they tried to imagine that I was their real child as well. So it was mutual. No one spoke of it, and I certainly didn't ask them. But I remember that I had one fantasy about our dad. I remember thinking that, fantasizing that he was a prince of the desert on a white horse. It's very childish, and I knew it was wasn't real, but still, it made me a little happy.
Our father tried to contact her only once, when he already had left our family to start the third family in Morocco.
And I said no. And I think I was 11 or 12. And I think I blocked my ears as well. I said that I didn't want to meet him, but that would destroy my world if I had to. So I didn't. I wanted to pretend that I didn't live in foster home. They felt like my own parents.
Maria knew about her mother that was mentally ill, and she knew about our father, but she didn't know that she had 6 siblings grown up just 1 hour away in Stockholm. But almost 10 years later, after the first and last time our father tried to contact her, that suddenly changed for good.
I remember it was an evening, there was a phone call. It was a woman that said, "Hello, you don't know me, but we are sisters." And
it was my sister Hafida who had found the birth certificate.
Oh my God. I didn't know how to react. And then she told me that have, she found a piece of paper with my name on it. And so she was able to look for me and find me. So we talked for a while, and then we decided that I was gonna come and visit her in Stockholm.
Maria takes up a diary from 1992, from when the phone rang. From the day she met my sister Hafida and some of my older sisters for the first time. At that time, I didn't know that they were going to meet.
It says...
I wasn't there.
I went to Stockholm and met my siblings for the first time. I was nervous and it was exciting and fun. We talked a lot during the day, and then we went out partying. That's all it says.
Her memory today is a memory of lost opportunity, of meeting siblings that is supposed to be your family, but in a way isn't.
And I remember standing by the entrance to the subway, waiting for her, not knowing if I was going to recognize her. How would it feel? Would we have similarities? Would we look the same?
Suddenly she's standing there, in front of Maria.
I was occupied by, on one hand, trying to act normal during such circumstances, and at the same time looking for similarities and behaviors or laughter. Can I feel that do we have the same laughter? Do we have the same interests? A really strange feeling.
And sitting here with Maria makes me realize something crucial. It sounds obvious when you say it out loud, but sometimes the obvious thoughts need the longest time to land. It wasn't Maria's decision to become a secret, but it was the secrets that prevented us from becoming a family.
It's difficult to...
becoming a real family.
Form a relationship with people that should have been your closest, but you meet them for the first time, and it's so much at stake. I think the one that contacted me got disappointed with me not being able to get close.
We became something different. We have lived a life in lies, a life with loose ends.
There's kind of a sorrow to know that you will not be able to ever form a tight bond with your siblings.
Have you ever thought about, now today, how you became a secret from us?
I think it's natural. It can create trouble in relationships, and you just need to forget. It's too hurtful to think about those things in your daily life. In the same way that I try to forget that I didn't live in my real home, but a foster home.
Do you think there's a reason why I'm doing this now? The whole radio documentary?
I feel a lot of stuff in your family that you haven't talked about. There's many things that are secrets still. And I think that makes you wonder what you don't know. Is there more? And... I think you have come to that age, and you have a child as well. So
I also think it's a little bit also I have an envy of my friends knowing their parents when they get old, and then knowing them as human beings. And I think this is a way of trying to understand our dad and try to a little bit put pieces together of who he was, like. What did he like to do? What did he laugh about? What did he like to look at?
Was he a funny person?
I agree. And I can't wait to know what you found out.
You've been listening to Secrets, a production of Showcase from PRX's Radiotopia and the podcast company Soundtelling. Host is Mohamed El Abed. Field reporter was Åsa Secker. The intro music was made by the Swedish artist Min Stora Sorg. The artwork was made by Sepidar Husseini. My name is Martin Johnson. I'm the producer, and the executive producer is Julie Shapiro.
Radiotopia from PRX.